We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the author, or I should say first, the host of The Agenda on Sirius XM Radio, the author of his most recent Lies Incorporated, The World of Post-Truth Politics, Ari Raibenhof. Welcome to the program.
Sam, thanks for having me.
Where can people get the agenda, Ari?
They can get the agenda on Sirius XM. So it's on channel 127 every morning, 6 a.m. East, 3 a.m. West. And shockingly, there does seem to be people listening in the West, because I do get West Coast callers in that first hour. I don't quite understand why they're up or why they haven't gone to sleep, but they do listen to the agenda.
And maybe you'll give everybody listening now a free trial membership to Sirius XM. I'm joking. All right, let's
get... I think you can actually get one of those if you go to their website.
Oh, really? I had no idea.
Yeah.
All right, well, fair enough. And so people can do that if they want. But let's talk about your book, because there's a lot of... there's a lot of issues in here that, you know, we deal with on a daily basis, and you've done a great job of sort of like... of doing the TikTok and the details of how these sort of almost zombie narratives in some way get born and live. In some cases, they die. But let's start with one which is very prominent at the moment, because I think it's come out by the time that this will air, that Time Magazine has a cover, and I imagine many people have already seen the cover by now, has a cover that's coming out. Dear Reader, it says on the top of the cover, it's a big red thing. You owe $42,998, and that's what every American man, woman, and child would need to pay to erase the $13.9 trillion U.S. debt. And there's a lot of lies. I mean, just putting aside the moment that the fact is that, you know, it's probably unlikely that if we were to have to pay off that debt in the way that their time is implying, that everybody would owe the same amount, since about 25% of the country's wealth is in the hands of about 3% of people. But putting that aside, there's a lot of other lies that involved around that notion of debt, isn't there?
Yes, and look, there's differences, right? There are policy disagreements, which we can have. Right. And then there's basic information, which is untruthful. And the people who obsess about debt, right, because most of the people who talk about debt most of the time do it as an excuse because they don't want to talk about something else. Meaning, right, talk to Republicans about the Iraq War and they're like, oh, that deficit doesn't matter. Right. In fact, Dick Cheney's quote, deficits don't matter. Right. But then when a Democratic administration takes over, they're like, oh, my God, the deficit is out of control. Oh, this is the most awful thing in the world. That's most of it. Then there's a kind of small cadre of people, mainly based in Washington, who actually care about debt. And there's one guy, literally one guy. His name is Pete Peterson. Right. And he has decided to spend $500 million of his own money trying to scare Americans about debt. And this effort and the people who they cite in Time Magazine are all about that issue. And they're all funded through him. Everything from the Simpsons-Bowles Commission, which I'm sure your audience knows about, Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, who did they go kind of work for after they were done with the commission? Pete Peterson's foundations.
Right.
When people talk about Reinhart and Rogoff and their false study, which I talk about a lot in the book, which said that if these are two Ivy League elite professors who came out with a study that was not peer-reviewed, by the way, and that's an important point here, that said if your country's debt rises above a certain level, your GDP goes negative.
Well, we should make that clear. If it rises above a certain level of a percentage of your GDP.
Right. It goes negative. And I want to get to a lie that's not in the book, but actually important about that I kind of called out earlier this year after the book was done. But on this first thing, if you go negative, if you rise to a certain level, if you cross 90%, right, then your economy goes into the crap bin, right, is what they wanted to say. The problem is a grad student at UMass at University of Massachusetts found that their data was wrong.
Right.
That they had miscoded their spreadsheet, and if you actually recalculated their spreadsheet, there really wasn't a widespread correlation between the idea of massive debts and economic problems. And this is because, and this goes against the entire notion that debt and deficits are a crisis that have to be dealt with. And the other problem is with these people is it's not that they think that debt and deficits are a crisis. It's how they want to deal with it, right? If you look at who's on their board, a lot of these people who participate in these activities are corporate CEOs who suck tons of money out of the Treasury through military contracts and other and tax schemes and all sorts of other things. And if you actually – but if you try to take those away, they all freak out. They want to fix the deficit by cutting things like Social Security, which has nothing to do with the deficit in the first place.
And, you know, just getting back to that Reinhart and Rogoff study, I mean, this was the intellectual foundation for the turn to austerity in this country and, frankly, in many respects, internationally as well.
It actually had a larger effect in Europe, I would say, than in the United States, because we kind of edged austerity. We did some things that we shouldn't have done, like the sequester, and we had fights about how big the stimulus should be. Like, we edged austerity, right? Europe, a lot of places went full-scale austerity and felt the burn of it, because the problem is how you get out of deficits is not – you don't cut to get out of deficits. You grow to get out of deficits, right? And by putting yourself into austerity at a time when the world was in recession, you basically said, I'm going to shrink growth right now. And what's the obvious outcome? People get hurt. And that's actually the problem with the deficit hawks, is they refuse to acknowledge the consequence of their actions, and they based a lot of what they were talking about on this phony and flawed study.
And we should add, you know, Pete Peterson, I'm quite convinced, or I was quite convinced, that Pete Peterson was supporting Chris Christie, and that a big part of Chris Christie's attempt to run on the idea of cutting Social Security was a function of Pete Peterson. And just to remind people, he was the former Commerce Secretary, I think, under Richard Nixon. He was it Black? Is it BlackRock Investments that Pete Peterson, just a huge hedge funder, willing to drop.
That went public, and then he got all the money out of it when it went public, which is where he got his fortune. The interesting thing is he claims that his whole focus on deficits happened when he was cutting a real estate deal for a house in the Hamptons in the early 80s, and part of the deal that he signed to buy this house in the Hamptons was he had to speak at a Women's Republican Economic Club, and that's when he discovered that deficits are bad and we have to cut Social Security. Now, back in the 80s, there actually was a huge problem with Social Security that got fixed by Tip O'Neill, Ronald Reagan, and the Alan Greenspan Commission back then. Right, we actually did face a huge immediate crisis in the 1980s, but he hasn't kind of looked. The problem is are there times when deficits matter and we should talk about them? Yes, but it's not all the time, especially not during times of economic turmoil. And he also doesn't really believe in share. He claims to believe in shared sacrifice, but all his solutions tend to overwhelmingly hit the poor.
Indeed. All right. So let's go to some other ones, because you the birth of lies, as you write in the book, or Lies Incorporated, really centered around tobacco. And this is, you know, the sort of the textbook case of an industry basically foisting its externalities on the taxpayer, the consumer, and then building an entire industry around lying about it.
Right. I mean, look, this is the thesis of the book. When you see these lies that emerge, these zombie lies, as we call them, I wrote this book because I became obsessed with where do these things come from, right? There has to be a lie, a zombie lie, just like a zombie apocalypse has to have a patient zero, right?
Right.
So I started looking at these lies and saying, who is the liar? Like, who is the liar? Because here's the problem. Pete Peterson's people, right, they write talking points and they give them to members of Congress. And most of the time you hear members of Congress saying something that's not true, they fully believe it's true, right? They've been given research by a staff member that's bad, a friend who happens to be a lobbyist told them something that's wrong. They aren't technically lying because lying requires intent. But somewhere in the process, there has to be someone who invented the lie. And when I started looking, I found this small group of people who profit either ideologically or monetarily from the creation of lies. And they've created a very clear methodology for how you create a lie and inject it into the public consciousness and use it to stop progress on a number of issues. And if you look, the kind of inventor of this process is John Hill, who was the founder of the public relations firm Hill & Knowlton, which people might remember some of their greatest hits. In addition to the tobacco industry, they were the babies being thrown out of incubators lie at the start of the first Iraq War. They worked for the asbestos industry. They've done a whole – you want to look at like evil PR campaigns of the 20th century. You know, John Hill is that chapter of the encyclopedia. So John Hill meets with the barons of the tobacco industry in the 1950s. And they sit down, fancy hotel in New York, and he says to them, you're doing the wrong thing. Because all the tobacco companies, people started to realize cigarettes were bad for your health, right? Mm. And John Hill, he actually realized cigarettes were bad for his health. You know how we know that? Because he quit smoking a few years before because he thought it was bad for his health. So they sit down. And they were marketing their cigarettes, and you can see these ads from the 1950s. Our cigarettes are the healthiest, right? That's how they were marketing them. And he said, no, 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 you guys can't do that. You can't compete against each other in this way. What you need to do is go at the science that says you guys are – your product causes cancer. Now, his research – the research on tobacco and cancer dates back actually – 30 years at that point, and we were pretty sure come 1960 that, you know, as sure as we are of climate change now, that tobacco smoking caused lung cancer. And you actually see this. There's a letter to the editor of The Atlantic after one of the PR, the doctors employed by the tobacco industry denied the link. There's a letter from a doctor from Harvard that I found in The Atlantic that's like, how can you be denying this? Like, the science is clear. But they used a methodology that we see today most prominently with climate change to deny it. And that's – that. Now, the thing is, if it was just tobacco and climate change, we'd have a singular story. But I started looking at the entire Obama administration, and every single major issue that Barack Obama dealt with during his administration – so healthcare, Betsy McCoy and death panels, climate, like we don't even need to go over the reams of lies about that. Right. Immigration, there's a whole network of liars set up on the immigration, in the immigration debate. Debt and deficits, we talked about Reinhard Rogoff and the attempt to turn us towards austerity. Voting rights, there's a guy named Hans von Spakovsky, which, by the way, is a great name for a movie villain, but he's actually a real-life villain whose entire goal for the past 16 years has been stripping Americans, has been disenfranchising voters. And he does that primarily based on lies.
Let's talk, I mean, go into some detail about von Spakovsky, because I remember he was one of the U.S. attorneys caught up a little bit, I think, if I remember correctly, in the U.S. attorney scandal under George W. Bush.
That was kind of tangentially related. Hans von Spakovsky was a Georgia kind of local figure who joined the Bush camp, the George W. Bush campaign, and was part of the Brooks Brothers riots in Florida mm-hmm. in 2000. He goes with Bush, the Bush administration, to the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division,
right. Okay,
and Voting Rights Division, where he basically halts a whole bunch. And politicizes that division. So when he gets appointed to the Federal Elections Commission by Bush, he's actually and Federal Election Commission appointments are rarely rejected because they're done in pairs. So when you do them, you put a Democrat and Republican up at the same time. His was rejected because he was such a bad actor at the Department of Justice. He goes to the Heritage Foundation and becomes kind of this person arguing for voter ID and all that. And if you look at people who study this, they say Hans von Spakovsky is the patient zero, and he does this by literally at every opportunity possible lying about the problem of voter fraud. And every time he talks, oh, this is a voter fraud problem, if you dig in, it just wasn't a voter fraud problem. Now, this was a part of the Bush administration because the Karl Rove, the U.S. attorney scandal, started when a number of U.S. attorneys, specifically one U.S. attorney in Arizona, who received awards for his voter fraud work, was not prosecuting Democrats vigorously enough on voter fraud. And so the justice, because there weren't any cases. And so Karl Rove tried to have him, and under political pressure, had him fired. And that's kind of the tangential relationship here. He has become the kind of centerpiece of lies about the voting rights. And if you look at all these efforts to push voter ID laws, they very much begin with him.
I mean, in each of these sort of issue silos, there seems to be, like you say, you sort of identify, I guess, the patient zero, if you will, and just healthcare. It's Betsy McCaffey in terms of in terms of the death panel and whatnot. Is on the next level, right, of sort of, I guess, amplifying these lies and, providing the conduit so that they infect the body politic. Are the players the same? Is the money coming from the same place, or does it vary on the issue set?
I mean, it varies on the issue set, but it's within the same goals and the same strategies, and there's kind of a learning curve that people are clearly using the same tactics. And there's a kind of other layer, which is always the connector, you kind of call it. So on the issue of LGBT rights, another example where a guy named Mark Regnerus wrote a completely phony study claiming that the children of gay parents have worse outcomes in life than the children of straight individuals, right? And this was used in court by the House of Representatives when they defended DOMA. It was used by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. It was used repeatedly, right? The study, can I curse, by the way? What are the rules?
Curse.
Okay. The study, when reviewed, it was published. The journal that published it hired somebody, a professor from the outside, to review how they ended up publishing this. And the Chronicle of Higher Education, not known for its outlandish and incendiary quotes, they went to the guy and they said, "What do you think of this study?" And he goes, "The study was bullshit." And those were it's bullshit. Like, and that's a sociologist talking, was like, to another sociologist. The American Sociological Association condemned the study. His own department distanced themselves from the study. So he received a $700,000 grant to do the study from an organization called Witherspoon, which is founded by a guy named Robert George, who, if you look, is on the board or at the center of literally every major anti-gay group in the country. Now, who is Robert George? He's a Princeton professor, very well-respected, highly liked Princeton professor, who is is very Catholic and bases a lot of his research and scholarship on kind of Catholic theology. He's so respected that, for example, when Pope Benedict visited the United States, he was one of the few people who received a private audience with the Pope.
Wow.
You have bishops in the United States who say, before I turn to make a public pronouncement, I always talk to Robert George. Like, this is a widely respected guy. He's done numerous studies on a variety of different theological things, has substantially written about how masturbation is a great moral evil, by the way.
That can cut both ways.
Maybe that's where Ted Cruz got it from. So he is kind of the connector of this world, and he helps, this foundation paid $700,000 for this University of Texas study by this professor, but it also needs to flow through that world, right, through the National Organization for Marriage, the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Commission. And by the way, Robert George has served in administrative posts, I think, from every president since Clinton.
Wow.
Because Republicans keep appointing him in their slots on different boards, Civil Rights Commission, et cetera, where he always just wreaks havoc, basically.
Wow. And so there's always a figure like this. I mean, give me one more guy that, I mean, that stood out for you, or woman that stood out for you as being particularly egregious.
I mean, egregious, they're all egregious, right? They're all, you know, Betsy McCoy is probably the most egregious, the woman who invented the death panel smear. The most interesting character to me is actually a guy named John Tanton. And John Tanton is an ophthalmologist in northern Michigan, and he's another one of these connectors. And he is at the center of the entire anti-immigrant movement in this country, is him. Like, every major group was founded or funded by him at one point or another. And what's interesting about him is he was a liberal, right? He was a Planned Parenthood Sierra Club guy in the 70s who became anti-immigrant, claiming that immigrants are destroying the environment in our country. And kind of became a right-wing anti-immigrant bigot.
How does that argument and go, that the immigrants are destroying the environment?
He said that, you know, our birth rates are flat. The only people who are coming here are immigrants, so they must be destroying our environment. This was not actually uncommon in some of the environmental community in the 70s. There actually was a major fight about this inside the Sierra Club. But he ended up leaving those organizations because they didn't become anti-immigrant. He wanted Planned Parenthood and the Sierra Club to turn anti-immigrant. They didn't. He left and started founding his own organization. So FAIR, which is a big anti-immigrant organization, not the media watchdog, the anti-immigrant organization. They're two different organizations, is one of them. Numbers USA, which you see ads for on TV, is another of his organizations. The Center for – he has a think tank that does studies. You know, and by the way, all of this stuff has – links to some white nationalist groups, et cetera, of course.
Well,
he's just a fascinating figure because you see this, you know, Robert George in the LGBT movement, this is a major intellectual figure at one of the most prestigious universities in the country, right? John Tanton is an ophthalmologist in northern Michigan. Like, the fact that he could become the center of this movement is actually pretty incredible.
That is amazing. Lies Incorporated, ladies and gentlemen, The World of Post-Truth Politics. Ari Rabenhoff, we will put a link at majority.fm to the book. Ari, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.